Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. It is Tuesday. It is just after 11:30, and that means we are going to consult a group of independent booksellers for this week's book picks. Today we are joined by Heather Boyne and Connie Brooks from Bat and Kill Books in Cambridge, New York, and Kathy Taylor from Northshire in Saratoga Springs and Manchester Center, Vermont. Very excited to see you all. Hello and welcome.
Good morning.
Kathy, is this your first time?
No.
Oh, okay.
This is my third.
Your third time? Oh, no. How humiliating for me. Oh, no.
It's been a while, though.
Okay.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
And I, of course, remember, and I'm... No. We'll just move on. I'll just be embarrassed and we'll move forward. Who would like to... Well, let's... Since I've misremembered that you'd been here before, let's begin with you. What book would you like to start with?
I'm going to begin with the first of four memoirs I'm going to mention today, and it is the wonderful There's Always This Year by Hanif Abdurraqib. I will say I actually listened to this book, and it was wonderful because you really fall into the rhythm of his voice. Abdurraqib is a poet and essayist. His most recent book was The Little Devil in America, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Like his previous title, this one defies genre, part memoir, part cultural critique, part sports book. The narrative begins in Columbus, Ohio, the city where Abdurraqib grew up and which he still considers home. One of the opening passages is a painstakingly tender observation of his father, specifically his father's hair, which mostly lay hidden beneath his kufi, and the idiosyncratic gestures he used while speaking and eating at the dinner table. It's these tender attentions that build into an aching love for a city, a state, and its people, his people, and his own personal account of growing up black and poor in this region. Basketball fans probably know the phrase, ball is life, and it certainly feels that way reading Abdurraqib on the sport. He writes as equally lovingly about the high school players he grew up watching, the ones he idolized and whose successes he details, whose feet never touched an NBA court, as he does the anointed players whose destiny did take them to the big arenas, like LeBron James, Ohio's own chosen one. James's own journey of beginning in Ohio and leaving and returning mirrors Abdurraqib's own and comes to serve as a metaphor for belonging, loss, and the eventual return to the promised land. There's also intertwined in basketball the very idea of the American dream, who has access to that dream, and who those in power want to keep out of the dream. He's a sharp cultural critic. Here he is in a passage that begins by speaking about the Fab Five, the famous early 90s squad at University of Michigan, and the way the media covered them. So much of the machinery of race and or culture-driven fear relies on who is willing to be convinced of what. How easy it is to manufacture weaponry out of someone else's living if the emphasis is placed on the right or wrong word, or if that word is repeated enough, perhaps in a hushed tone. It's an incisive, exhilarating, beautiful book told in language as powerful as the content.
There's Always This Year by Hanif Abdurraqib. That sounds fantastic. It is a memoir of love and basketball. Mm-hmm. Heather or Connie?
All right. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about a book called Vignettes by Sean Shearer. Vendome Press is a preeminent publisher of illustrated books on fine arts, photography, architecture, travel, and culture. It's a large format book, and it's beautifully produced. Sean is a designer, collector, and proprietor of Cabinet and Kammer, named after the Renaissance tradition of the Wonder Kammer, a collection of natural and manufactured curiosities. His shop is in Franklin, New York, in the Catskill Mountains near Oneonta. He's also an art history teacher at SUNY Oneonta, the very place I got my art history degree at. Hmm. I unfortunately did not have him as a teacher, although I had great teachers, everyone. Go Dragons. All right. Some listeners may know that Sean's partner, fashion designer Gary Graham, was a finalist on Making the Cut, which is an offshoot of the television series Project Runway. And I say this because they both share an aesthetic for using antique and historic objects in their work. Sean's store is an expression of his ethos and his vision. The store functions as a curated gallery space, a culmination of years of collecting and pursuing the extraordinary. Journalist Anderson Cooper, who Sean worked with and who wrote the introduction to Sean's previous book, said Shear has the unique ability to place otherwise ordinary objects in a completely unexpected context or grouping, and in doing so, changing the way you see them. The book is beautifully illustrated with his own photographs, images taken of his own personal collection, his shop, and collections of the homes of his many friends and colleagues. But it's more than just a pretty home design book. The photos go beyond the purely representational. They become images akin to Rembrandt's still lifes, the colors, the moods, and compositions evoking old master paintings. I find myself picking up vignettes to get lost in the atmosphere of the images. He evokes a world of warm beauty, an homage to the worn and wonderful.
It's Vignettes by Sean Shearer. It sounds gorgeous. I am going to have to check that out and probably the store as well. Kathy, let's go to you again.
Okay. The next memoir I'm going to speak about is one called Hereafter by Amy Lynn, which is a debut book. It is a memoir written in the aftermath of her young husband's sudden death. It's a slender book written in the form of small chapters that I think capture well the fragmented logic of grief. The chapters also go backward and forward in time in the same way grief sort of unhinges you from any straight or recognizable timeline. There was no indication her husband would die that day in the way he did, and the book captures his death as almost an eruption of reality. The life you thought you were going to have with this person who is very real and very much a part of you and the world is abruptly and irrevocably gone. Her writing about their love is incredibly tender and yearning, and her writing about the aftermath, the literal hereafter, is searing in its painful attentiveness to this disabling and disorienting task of remaining in a world without your beloved. Lynn really has no time for the famous five stages of grief, which she notes was actually created by Elizabeth Kübler-Ross to describe people with terminal illnesses who had to come to terms with their own death, and then made to fit for people who were left behind after a loved one's death. Often, though, these stages are not linear, or even if they do arrive for a person linearly, grief can still surface years later in unpredictable, messy cycles. Lynn writes, "I cannot believe how much pain we are asked to bear when we are alive. How, even if there is a way, no one can show us how to live with it." It's a beautiful book that I think strives to capture the seemingly impossible way we must all balance life's pain and joy and fear and beauty.
It's Hereafter by Amy Lynn, a memoir of grief, which we cannot talk enough about. Mm-hmm. I will also be checking that one out. Connie.
Yeah, that one sounds great, Kathy. Yeah. I brought in a series of fantasy novels, so this first one couldn't be more different from the books that you guys have talked about. But
that's okay. That's why we like it.
I escape into fantasy often. And so the first one I have brought to tell you all about today is The Book of Doors, which is by debut author Gareth Brown. And The Book of Doors was conceived and written during the COVID lockdown, which perhaps explains the author's fantasy that plays out in the story of any door becoming an escape route to another place entirely. The story begins with ordinary, unassuming Cassie Andrews. She's a young woman who works in a New York City bookstore. And late one evening, a lonely yet charming older customer dies in the store and leaves behind a book that is clearly meant for Cassie. And if this is all sounding very mysterious, it is. The book she discovers has a rare and magical quality. If wielded properly, it can turn any door, a bathroom door, a closet door, a stairwell door, into a door to anywhere. Now, at first, Cassie and her roommate, Izzy, use the book as a mere lark. They pop into bars around town, and they visit favorite vacation spots around the world, like you might do.
That's what I would do, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Venice. Venice is actually her first destination. But all too quickly, they come to realize that possession of the book puts them into very great danger, and that their book is not the only one of its kind. All I'm going to say.
All
no
right.
What?
That's The Book of Doors by Gareth Brown. Do you want to group your fantasy?
I could, sure. I can go through these pretty quickly. So, yeah, keeping the fantasy with the fantasy. So, the next one I have is The Stardust Thief by Chelsea Abdullah. Chelsea Abdullah is a Kuwaiti American writer who was born and raised in Kuwait, where she grew up listening to stories from 1001 Nights about mysterious desert creatures and wily heroes. In The Stardust Thief, Luli Al-Nazari is known as the Midnight Merchant. She's a small-time criminal whose specific trade is a smuggler of magical items. When she saves the life of a cowardly prince, she draws the attention of his powerful father, the Sultan, who blackmails her into finding an ancient lamp reported to have great power. With no choice but to obey the Sultan or be executed, Luli journeys with the Sultan's oldest son to find the artifact. Aided by her bodyguard, who has secrets of his own, they must survive attacks from ghouls, outwit a vengeful djinn queen, and confront a malicious killer from Luli's past. The Stardust Thief is a rollicking, fantastical thriller with a very winsome cast, and you will absolutely fall in love with Luli. She's magnificent.
Fantastic. The Stardust Thief by Chelsea Abdullah.
And then my trifecta of fantasy for you all today is The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is a brand new one in hardcover. And if your idea of a good time is reading a magical novel set during the Spanish Inquisition, then do I have the book for you. And we get that request all the time.
Oh, sure.
In, they're like, I want Spanish Inquisition. I want magic.
Yeah. It's the Roman Empire for a subset.
And we go, yeah, of course, I gotcha. So in Leigh Bardugo's new novel, The Familiar, we meet a nondescript scullery maid named Luzia Cotado. Luzia toils away her days in a shabby house in Madrid until the day that her mistress discovers that Luzia might possibly use just a little tiny bit of magic to get through her tasks during the day. Armed with this knowledge, the mistress demands that Luzia uses her gifts to improve the family's social position. What begins as simple amusement for the nobility takes a perilous turn when Luzia garners the notice of Antonio Perez, the disgraced secretary to the king. Still reeling from the defeat of his armada, the king is desperate for any advantage in the war against England's heretic queen, and Perez will stop at nothing to regain the king's favor. So there, you have plenty of fantasy.
We're all set
into
up.
The month of May.
The Book of Doors, The Stardust Thief, The Familiar. The Familiar is by Leigh Bardugo, and that is Connie's fantasy trifecta for today.
That's right.
Kathy?
Okay, the next memoir about grief I'm going to be
When I looked down, I should have paired these.
I don't know. I was on a kick. the next one is Grief is for People by Sloane Crosley, an essayist and novelist. This memoir actually chronicles two griefs over the course of one summer and the curious way in which they converge and mimic each other. The first is the theft from Crosley's apartment of all her jewelry, both sentimental and valuable, by a thief who enters her bedroom window while she is briefly gone for a doctor's appointment. The second is the sudden death of her best friend a month later. I spoke about the five stages of grief earlier, and this memoir is broken down under those familiar themes: anger, denial, depression, bargaining, and acceptance. I would argue her narrative sort of flouts the easiness of those categories, though, especially because lending a different sense of anguish to her friend's death is the fact that he made the decision to end it. A decision that she wrestles with and interrogates throughout the book. The death also lends a sort of mad, frantic desperation to her attempts to retrieve any of the stolen jewelry, which leads her on some really interesting crazy side quests to do, as if by retrieving the jewelry, she can retrieve her lost friend. Her writing is very funny amidst the pain, and I would very much recommend it.
It's Grief is for People by Sloane Crosley. Joe Donahue did interview Sloane about this book on the Roundtable, and that interview's online at WAMC.org. It is, you've reminded me that I wanted to also get this book, and because the interview was very funny and compelling, too.
She's very funny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Heather.
All right. Another book about life. Chasing Beauty, The Life of Isabella Stewart Gardner by Natalie Dykstra. In 1990, thieves broke into the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and pulled off one of the biggest art thefts in history. They stole 13 priceless works of art, including a Vermeer and an exceedingly rare Rembrandt seascape. The value of the haul exceeded $500 million. And over 34 years later, they still have not found these works of art. The infamy of the heist, though, has overshadowed the collection and the story of its founder, Isabella Stewart Gardner. In her new book, Chasing Beauty, Natalie Dykstra shifts the focus back onto the founder, exploring the stories and scandals, the myths surrounding the woman who often defied the expectations of her gender and her class. And by the summer of 1891, Isabella had inherited a lot of money from her father. And with that, it was said, Ms. Gardner settled down to the business of collecting works of art. She and her husband traveled Europe, purchasing master paintings and tapestries, rare books and prints and porcelains. And when her husband died in 1898, she realized their shared dream and they built a suitable space to exhibit their treasures. Now, if the art in this book does not captivate you, the fact that Gardner was friends with famous figures of the day, the writer Henry James, the painter John Singer Sargent, might. And the host of her contemporaries will take you on a name-dropping journey through the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Natalie Dykstra weaves a vivid and masterful story of Isabella, creator of one of America's most stunning museums, an American original whose own life was remade by art. It is published by Mariner Books, and it's in your favorite indie bookstore right now.
Chasing Beauty, The Life of Isabella Stewart Gardner by Natalie Dykstra. Kathy, let's go back to you.
Okay, my last memoir here is Splinters by Leslie Jamison, who's the author of several essay collections, one of which is The Empathy Exams, which I also liked very much, and a book on addiction and sobriety called The Recovering. This new memoir recounts her decision to leave her marriage when her daughter is not yet a year old. There are elements of grief here, too. Anger, much of which is her husband's and which she attempts to understand, especially as a shroud for his own pain. The failure she feels at not being able to stay and give her daughter a household with two parents. And the reckoning of the ways in which her own childhood as the daughter of divorced parents informed her own decisions and desires. She wonders if she has always sought out the crossing of thresholds rather than stability with its infinite sameness. Jamison's agile, curious mind probes the complexities of balancing motherhood with creating art, how to nourish your baby and tend your own self, without guilt or shame, the two companions working mothers seemingly must carry. It's a wonderful, thoughtful, gratifying read.
It sounds lovely. Splinters by Leslie Jamison. Connie.
Oh, my. Okay, back to me.
Back to you.
I have a very different book from my the other three that I brought in. Mm-hmm. This is Voices of the People by Joseph Brujac and illustrated by various artists. Joe did a talk at our store last week, and so I had not been aware of this book, but I became aware of it. It came out last year. And in it, through 34 poems, Abenaki writer Joseph Brujac introduces readers to important indigenous leaders, from the peacemaker in 1000 AD to modern-day dancer Maria Tallchief and Cherokee chief Wilma Mankiller. Each poem is accompanied by an illustration from a contemporary Native American artist. The combination is a vibrant book that highlights the achievements of notable Native Americans from the past, paired with modern, fresh, and affecting contemporary Native art. It's kind of a large format. I would call it picture book, but it's not picture book for children, although it could be.
Sure.
But it's, I guess, more I would put it in like the, I guess, the art section of,
a
library or a bookstore. Mm-hmm. It's stunning, and the poems are amazing, and the art itself is surprising and just captivating, and it's just a really lovely book.
Voices of the People by Joseph Brujac, illustrated by various artists. Kathy, back to you.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears here to a historical novel called The Adversary by Michael Crummy, whose previous book, The Innocents, was another Northshire staff favorite. This particular violent, grim, and remarkable novel begins in 18th century Newfoundland, a cold and barren place that seems beset by snow and ice most of the time and by great winds and storms the rest of it. The scene opens on an ill-fated wedding that is taking place between the degenerate, almost always drunk, Abe Strapp, who is the son of a recently deceased merchant, and the daughter of a man whose firm Abe hopes to inherit. Arriving to disrupt the event, though, is the widow Keynes, a formidable, enigmatic, and calculating figure who sports the green coat and trousers of her recently deceased husband. She has brought along a young pregnant servant girl whose baby may or may not belong to Abe. This doomed wedding is only the first in a series of matchups between the widow and Abe, who have long-standing unfinished business to settle. Theirs is a great chess match, and the people who inhabit the coastline seem to be but pawns in their game. Abe makes for a fantastic villain. You can't wait to see if he's going to get what he deserves. And though the action and characters are often dark, Crummy's visceral and colorful, very, very colorful language, makes the tale a true page-turner. It's an enrapturing novel about an epic struggle of wills that ultimately consumes the lives of the widow and Abe and brings those in their orbit to ruin.
Ooh.
It's great.
Drama. It's great. The yeah. Adversary yeah. by Michael Crummy.
And wow, Newfoundland, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love Newfoundland.
There's all kinds Crummy. Of yeah. secret things happening.
I was going to say, Scandinavia.
And no one ever dies.
Never. All right, in a completely different vein, McSweeney's Quarterly Concern began in 1998 as a literary journal that published only works rejected by other magazines. But since then, McSweeney's has attracted some of the finest writers in the world. It's a journal that continues to be a major home for new and unpublished writers as well. Each issue is completely redesigned. Each is a unique work of art based on a theme. Some issues are hardcovers, some paperbacks. Number 16 came with a deck of cards containing the story told on 13 interchangeable playing cards. But number 73 is a sizable book that includes a poster and a fold-out reproductions of the original documents. The theme is manifesto. Contained within is a subjective and selective group of manifestos, written from 1909 until today, all roaring with outrage. Plans for a Better World, featuring life and history-changing works from André Breton, Bertrand Russell, Valerie Solanas, Gorilla Girls, Dadaist, Futurist.
He's the next one.
Yeah. He's the next one, yes. Plus a brand new works from brilliant radical thinkers Eileen Miles and James Hanaham. So why read a collection of often rage-filled, I just can't take it anymore, proclamations? Well, as the introduction says, we need manifestos. They are often strange, ill-considered, and regrettable. They are just as often brilliant and pivotal in changing government, art, and the direction of the human animal. But always, manifestos are passionate. Always, they command attention and use language for perhaps its most urgent purposes, the rattling of complacent minds. The perfect gift for the recent graduate or the curious and rebellious friend. A striking silver fur-textured surface is what you got me to pick it up in the first place. Sure. It's amazing.
Add a texture.
Book. You want to touch it. You want to put it on your coffee table. You want people to pick it up. And this is a true story. When I first set out writing about this, I was sitting on my shift at the store. A couple came in without saying a word. They picked up a copy, and they bought it. It was one of those surreal moments that said, you chose the right book to talk about. So McSweeney's is sold as a subscription, but you can get single copies from where? Find independent bookstores everywhere.
McSweeney's issue 73, Manifesto. We have time for one more very quickly, but you each have one left. Who's going to...
I can talk very quickly about Burnham Wood, if that's all right. I've become an evangelist for this book. So Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton. It's been on Book Picks before when it was in hardcover, which is why it gets a really quick mention from me today.
Great.
Came out in paperback last month. And we just, we're reading it right now for the store book club. And there are very few books that I finish and I was speechless. And I also wanted to scream and cry, and I need to talk to more people about this book. So I'm on here to say that more people need to read it, y'all, because I need to talk about it. My feelings. Burnham Wood, Eleanor Catton. Yeah. It's set in New Zealand. It's amazing. Dwight Garner, in his review for The Times, said it crackles, and it does. It crackles.
That's Burnham Wood. Kathy's last book was by Miranda July, who I love. I'm so sorry we didn't get to talk about it.
So good.
But
all
we'll talk about it off air and just tease people. Northshire.com, battenkillbooks.com. You're listening to The Roundtable.